Hello and welcome back to the Tread Lightly podcast. I am Laura, your co-host and running coach at Laura Norris Running.
And I'm your co-host and running coach, Amanda Brooks at Run to the Finish. So today's episode will be a lot of fun because we are diving into some of your most asked questions. I think it's going to be very, very helpful. We'll try to make sure there are some timestamps in the notes so that you can skip around if you need to, but you know, listen to it all because you never know what you're going to learn.
Exactly. My theory is if someone asks the question, probably a lot of other people have the same question and just haven't asked yet. So we're going to dive straight into these. It's a whole plethora of topics today. Our first comes from @Hannah_Erickson1234. And she wrote in, I would love to listen to an episode on high school athletes, especially girls, and their different nutritional needs, how to get your period back, and how to prevent eating disorders and excessive exercise disorders from coming out of running. I see a lot of these issues in the cross-country sport at my age. This would be very helpful for young athletes and parents who want to make sure they are eating and exercising healthily. I absolutely love the podcast and have learned so much. Thank you.
Oh, this is such a big topic. I think I probably have to start by saying Lauren Fleshman's book is a good place to start. Good for a girl. It's very, I think, relatable, a lot of insights. I'm not sure it's actionable exactly, but a lot of insights that I think can just help change words. And even having some young girls read that and start to look at themselves as more powerful and not as needing to be thin to be the best, but seeing strong as being better. And then always, anytime we start to get into food, I think both Laura and I will always say, try to talk to a registered dietitian. We are not that. We have ideas, but we are not that. And certainly we have a ton that we're happy to recommend on social media who do a great job of sharing information.
Yeah. And I think to build off that point, it can be really helpful to, you know, for young kids who are on social media to cultivate your social media feed in people who help put out a positive message. So follow registered dietitians who support eating for performance and body positivity. Follow athletes like Lauren Fleshman. Follow running influencers who put forth body positivity and don't talk about, you know, being as thin as humanly possible. Now, I understand that social media is only a small facet of where you're getting information from. If you're on cross country, you're probably hearing things from your coaches, from your teammates, from your parents, maybe even. And there are a few things I would say. So if you overhear disordered eating comments coming from coaches, do not hesitate to speak out, even ask your school to do something about it. Maybe ask them to bring in a speaker, an RD instead, to talk about that. A lot of times they will follow where the athletes lead, but some coaches can be stuck in a really old school mindset that they don't even understand how damaging it is. For parents, I would really encourage them to not make comments about their own bodies or not make comments about bad foods. Encourage your kid to eat enough. And at the teenage years, that can be very, very large quantities of food. Don't create shame around what your kid eats. Also, avoid comments about like, oh, I got to go burn off these calories and stuff. When you talk about your running to your kid, talk about what you enjoy, how it makes you feel good, how you enjoy the competition. The other thing I'd say is sport diversity can be really beneficial. And part of it is because there's different body types in different sports, and exposing yourself to seeing people who might be more muscular or larger doing well in a sport can help shift your focus of understanding what athletic looks like.
I definitely grew up in a household where there was a lot of negative talk about food and body image. And it really wasn't until I got a little bit older and started having this idea of, gosh, it's really not that fun to hang around people who are consistently speaking badly about their body or someone else's body or about food. It's just sort of this constant like, gosh, well, I don't really want to be that either. So what did I need to change? And for me, it was a lot of reframing. So it was starting to look at, how can I fuel my body? What can I eat so that I'm going to have enough energy so that I can perform well, so that I can do the things I want, so that I can have enough energy? And that is starting to sort of think of yourself and your cross-country team as we're athletes. Athletes fuel themselves. Athletes aren't out there trying to like cut every calorie. They're thinking, what is going to help me run my fastest, be my best, be my strongest? And sometimes I love having people just look at some of like the top track and field athletes. They're very muscular and they aren't getting that from not eating, because to build muscle, you've got to eat. And so, like you said, some of it can be just a little bit of that shifting of who are we looking at to find body positive information, and just keep us kind of going in the right way. So things to look out for if you're kind of seeing some of this, especially in young girls, if there is, you know, patterns where they are suddenly eating less and you know they're still exercising more, they've mentioned losing their period. Don't be afraid to say to your friends or to speak up to someone else that, hey, I think something's going on and I really just want us all to be our healthiest. I want us to feel our best. I don't want anyone to have stress fractures, because we know that's kind of one of the big things that happens. High school kids, girls especially, go into college and almost immediately start having these big injuries. And it is that combination of having been under fueling. So think of how you can sort of, to me, it's always if I see something, how can I phrase this in the most positive way to bring it to your attention? And the most positive way is, man, I can't wait for us to keep running next year, but we've got to be really strong and healthy to do that. Those kinds of things I think can really help.
Absolutely. And the other thing I'll add is, like, if you are the one struggling with it, tell someone, reach out to a mental health professional. A lot of times eating disorders can come concurrently with anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, and oftentimes they are categorized as a mental health disorder with some of the highest mortality rates of mental health disorders. So this isn't something of just like, oh, some people are so skinny, I just want to be super skinny. This is mental health. This is your long-term health. Seek help sooner than later. And like, if it ends up being that you were a little too worried, it's better to be too worried than to end up being one of the statistics of an eating disorder gone wrong.
For sure. Okay, the next question. I know that this one was caused by something I said on the show. So at Nixon J said, my question is, I ran my first marathon this past October, finishing in 5 hours. You mentioned on the last episode that you can run your easy runs too easy, but I see all over Instagram that easy isn't a pace and you can't run too easy. So I'm trying to figure all of this out. Okay, I absolutely said this. And it's one of those things that doesn't apply to the majority of people. So the good example that I could give you is if your easy effort, so mine is like 140 heart rate. I probably do a lot of my runs like 130 even. If I started doing all of my easy runs at more like 115 heart rate, then I'm probably losing the effect that I was actually going after. And most of you haven't been doing low heart rate training the way I have. So your easy may be like 145 right now. And if all of a sudden you were only doing 115 and that meant you were doing like a slow walk compared to previously doing run walk, then yes, you're like losing the impact of the appropriate aerobic effort that we're going after. So that's what I meant by it can be too easy. And again, I have recovery runs where I do stay really, really low like that. And I have other easy days where I am closer to like 140. So it's a variation, but that is where I was going with it.
Which I, when you made that comment, I understood very much what you were saying. I was like, yeah, I completely agree with that. And then you realize, yes, there's a lot of nuance here. The thing I would add to that is, so for me, I think there can be too slow if like your form is absolutely falling apart, which will happen for a lot of people when they get to this point where they're going so slow that it's almost more efficient to walk, but they're trying to run. And you aren't just a set of lungs. You have a musculoskeletal system that we're trying to stress and trigger adaptations to. And also in running, we want to have good form reinforced for good running economy. We want to load your musculoskeletal system. And so that's kind of like where I always, for my athletes, point out, like, if your form is just absolutely falling apart, it's way different than it usually is, that's too slow for you individually. Use run walk then, or just, you know, let your heart rate be what it is, because chances are it's still in the easy zone above that. And then also, like, all this heart rate stuff and zone one, zone two is dependent on your volume of training. So you will see elite runners do some runs with their heart rate super, super low. And again, you know, some of them are genetic anomalies, so they're going to have super low heart rates, but they're also doing very high volume training. Most of us are not doing high volume training, so we get a little bit more bang for our buck solidly being in that zone two versus going out every easy run at a recovery effort. We have to think about training load and adaptations as time and intensity. And the lower volume you do, the more you want to be maybe in that like 130s, 140s heart rate that Amanda was talking about.
Training load. Really, that's one of my favorite terms, to get people to think of their holistic training and not just one run at a time. Okay, next question. I really like this one because I think it's really interesting. So I have a question about reducing fiber intake during race week. I'm a registered dietitian, but not a sports dietitian, and I'm feeling a little panicky with every article that recommends avoiding fiber for 3 days leading up to the race day. I'm wondering what the optimal level of fiber intake is before and if cutting back for me would actually result in GI issues. Love to hear your thoughts or any articles or studies.
This is a really great question because I think it's a very runner dependent question. It's very individual. On one end, you have runners who don't want to consume too much fiber before a race because doing so could lead to getting runner's trots and urgent bathroom breaks during the race. On the other hand, you have some runners who, if they cut it out too much, then they have to worry about constipation leading up to their race, which is not fun either. So we hear these 3 days. That's not what it's going to look like for everyone. The most common recommendation I've came across in my school books was for athletes with a history of GI symptoms to cut back 2 days before their race. That was from Jay Kundrup's Sport Nutrition. Then otherwise, the recommendation is no fiber in the meal before, maybe like two meals before. So that'd be like the dinner the night before your race. That's a lot different than cutting it out 3 days before. What I encourage athletes is to test this out in training. Try it before a long run. Try it before a big race pace workout. And then also look at fiber as like different types. Raw cruciferous vegetables are digested much differently than a bowl of oatmeal with fruit. Both have fiber, but some of them, the cruciferous vegetables, have more gas-producing fiber that leaves more residual stuff in the GI tract. And that's, again, another individual thing, but it's something to consider.
Nancy Clark, at one point in one of her books, had said she recommended 10 grams of fiber a day in the days leading up to the race and to have your fiber early in the day. So 10 is very low, but that is kind of when you're stuffing your face with nothing but bread and bagels because you're carb loading and drinking juices even, very possible to stay there. I think, again, she made a very specific point that she eats very high fiber. And so her GI system is very used to that. So a little different than someone who maybe is kind of moderately eating fiber and then they're traveling, they have a big salad, like, okay, big salad the day before your race, maybe not great because you haven't normally been eating that way. I will say for myself, I don't have a ton of GI issues. I do eat a lot of fiber, so I can have a salad even 2 days before the race. But then usually that last day before the race, I'm sticking to sandwiches and salmon, potatoes, things that are, like you said, just much easier to digest, going to be lower in fiber. So maybe you don't need to take it out for 3 days, but you're kind of like weaning yourself down. And as always, we've said this multiple times, but what you're doing prepping for a race, what you're doing for fueling during a race is not what we're saying to do all the time. So you can go right back to your high fiber. But I would try and just slowly cut down. And then, like Laura said, testing, like give yourself, maybe if you're doing a marathon, have a practice half marathon and see what happens if you go low fiber for a couple of days and just see what happens.
I think that's all really sound advice, and it might take trial and error. So if it doesn't work in one race, try something different. And again, like I do think a lot of runners eat very high fiber. And so even cutting down for us might be cutting down to normal levels of fiber. The other thing to consider is fiber is very filling. And so during your carb load, some people do cut it out because even if they would benefit from it, simply they can't have the stomach room for a full carb load and a huge salad. It's just, it's a lot of volume.
100%. That is definitely part of like cutting down on it just so you can really get in those carbs.
Our next question is also on GI issues, and this comes from at Courtney Bundrick. She said, I was listening to episode 19 and it was mentioned knowing all about gels for sensitive stomachs. Can you please share recommendations? Goo does not sit well with me.
Yes. So we definitely have some recommendations. I will give you a few. And then since Laura deals with GI issues, I will let her chime in with even more. So some of the things that we generally know work for a lot of people are maple syrup, honey sticks, scratch or tailwind hydration. Spring energy gels work for quite a few people if it's kind of the ones that are basically like an applesauce pouch. Again, you've got to kind of test that for yourself. Welch's fruit snacks, those work for a ton of people. Honestly, candy. Candy is just sugar. Like that is sport gel beans. Like they're just jelly beans with like a $10 price tag. So as long as you're taking in electrolytes with like some of those things, that's the big thing that they're trying to put a lot of times in a gel is not just the carbs, but a lot of times they're saying, hey, this also has these electrolytes. So if you're going with kind of one of those options, try to make sure you're drinking electrolytes. We know that bananas in general are good for a sensitive stomach. So not terribly easy to carry on the run, but there's Barnana is a brand out there. They do dried bananas. They also do like, I think pretzels, banana kind of things. So that could be an option. Dried pineapple works for a lot of people because pineapple is actually bromelain that's in it, is in a lot of digestive enzymes. But I know Laura has mentioned dried fruit was a no-go for her.
Yeah, for some people, dried fruit is a lot of fiber, a lot of fructose. And I also know like some runners just love gels because they're convenient and easy to carry, easy to take, which is an obstacle with whole foods. So I'm going to give some recommendations on gels for sensitive stomachs. I'm going to break them into two categories, low FODMAP, which I'll define in a moment, and ones that don't require water to digest, and I'll get more into why that can help. So FODMAP is an acronym that stands for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols, which are short-chain carbohydrates that are not well absorbed in your intestine. For some sensitive people, especially if you have, say, IBS or IBD, this can cause GI upset, especially in the really high quantities that you are taking gels in during a race. Like you're probably taking 5 or 6 or 7 over your marathon. That's a lot. So if you fall into that category, and you might tell you're in that category if things like broccoli or cauliflower or beans or onions sit really poorly with you, you might be sensitive to FODMAPs, fructose. And if that's the case, there are some gels that are low in fructose. Huma gels are one that are low FODMAP. I have seen them work really well for athletes, including those who have conditions like IBS and IBD. So that's a really great one to consider. There's tons of flavors. Some have caffeine, some are high electrolyte, which is great. spring can work well for FODMAP-sensitive athletes, except you want to avoid the apple flavor because apple is high in FODMAPs, and you want to avoid the high-fat ones. So those are kind of the gels that sit well with those who might be sensitive to FODMAPs. The other ones I've seen sit really well, might not work for people sensitive to large amounts of fructose, but will work if the issue is often triggered to you're not good about getting in enough water or you're prone to dehydration. When you take a gel like a goo, you're supposed to take 4 to 6 ounces of water with it for it to be properly absorbed in your gut. If you don't do that, you have GI issues. So Morden, Cis Beta, and Precision Hydration do not require water to be taken with these. I have a lot of runners who really love Morden. It helps them not get like general GI issues during a marathon when the intensity is higher. It's a hydrogel. It's absorbed in the small intestine, so it passes through the stomach without issue. I've seen people take those like every 20 minutes in a marathon and not have issues, feel great. The Cis and the Precision ones are more those like isotonic liquidy ones. Some people find they go down really easy. So that's what I would recommend for gels is trial essentially Huma, Spring, Morden, Cis, Precision. See what sits best with you.
Perfect. Honey Stinger, I mentioned Honey Sticks, but Honey Stinger works for a lot of people, whether it's gels, chews, or they have kind of their little waffles. Our next question I actually put here because it is directly related to what you were talking about. So Doug said, some gels require water to be taken with the gel and some don't, which are isotonic gels. The latter seem to be pre-mixed with water. Wouldn't those have a better chance of being absorbed for quicker energy than one that may mix with water you take, let alone chews, which should take even longer?
That's a great question because it comes into play the marketing that companies like Cis use, as well as some of the stuff we talk about. So when we look at it from a physiology perspective, absorption is dependent on a few factors. The type of carbohydrate, so glucose and fructose, are absorbed at different rates. Your overall diet, and that includes carb intake outside of running, and then how well you've trained your gut. The more carbs you take and the more you practice taking carbs while running, the more gut transporters your body makes for those carbs, so your absorption increases. Sodium also is a role in carbohydrate absorption, and then hydration status plays a role. So the isotonic gels can help because they don't need to be taken with water. They sit a little easier. They have their glucose and fructose optimized for absorption, but they're not always superior to other gels out there, based on just the fact that they're isotonic, at least in my understanding and what I've seen.
Agree. And if you kind of haven't heard this term isotonic, it's basically saying that the concentration of the cells inside your body and this product are the same. So it's not looking for water to be moving back and forth. So it should empty from your stomach quickly. You shouldn't need to take in all that water we mentioned. The downside for some folks is that these isotonic gels are often a much higher volume. So it's a large package. And at least for me, when I am running at race pace, it's harder to take in a big volume of something. So for me, that's a little bit of a problem. But if I also don't have to wash it down with 4 to 6 ounces of water, okay, maybe just something I personally would need to practice, but know that it's going to be much larger, a bigger volume. I think the other thing to remember is that just because this gel doesn't need as much water doesn't mean you get to skip drinking. You still need to keep hydrating so that we don't cause other issues.
Yes. Yeah. They're not a replacement for water. I've heard a lot of athletes say the same problem. Like they're like, I'm supposed to carry 5 of these giant gels because they're also on the lower end of carbohydrates for a lot of them. They'll be like 20 grams versus your Morden or your Huma that has 25 grams. 5 grams might not seem like a lot, but it makes it up over time. Now, if you like them, go for it, but they're not superior.
Yeah, I think you said it very well. There's a lot of marketing that happens around all of these products. It's the same reason I just told you jelly beans are the same thing as sport beans. They're just, you know, $10 less. A lot of these things, people don't seem to believe that candy is the same thing, but it is. It's basically the same thing, just depending on which product you're looking at. It's carbs and sugar, and that's all your body's looking for.
Yes, yes. This next question has some marketing claims at play also. So at Lily Beltane wrote in, loving the podcast content. I was wondering if you could talk about Curran Z. If you do a part two on supplements, I see a lot of trail ultra runners sponsored by them at the moment.
Yes. So I have seen a crazy amount of this, and it's not even this product alone. So for anyone who doesn't know this supplement, it's using black currant, which is a berry. It's actually been around for a super long time, like 2016, they started talking about this product. So it just kind of comes in and out of, I feel like, trends of who's trying what and talking about what. Some of the big claims from it are that it increases time to exhaustion and it improves fat oxidation.
Yes. Now, the studies that are out there, there's a few really important things to know about the studies making these claims. One is that a lot of them use short-term supplementation protocols, 7 days. And so if you're thinking about taking the supplement, take that in consideration. It's not necessarily studied as something you take every single day long-term. It's studied as a short-term intervention. Second, some of the studies were funded by the companies that make these products. That's a conflict of interest. It's not saying that the studies are wrong or that the data is poor, but it is just a factor we have to consider. Now, things that the evidence has reviewed, there's a really good overview in the International Journal or the Journal of the International Society of Sports Nutrition. They talked about this, and still a lot of research has to be done. There may be a small effect on performance. However, a lot of these studies have been done on untrained athletes or like low-level trained athletes, not highly trained athletes. And with a lot of supplements such as beet juice, beta-alanine, etc., you see more impact on untrained athletes than you see on trained athletes. So if you're a trained athlete and you're looking at these supplements, know that the benefit you get from them may not be as pronounced as they're claiming in the studies that used untrained athletes.
And I think we see this a lot because there's always some berry or fruit that is the new superfood, the new thing that's going to help us. Gosh, I went through a phase of paying $8 bajillion for goji berries because they were supposed to be the best food ever. So I think this probably is not going to harm you. So if you're like, gosh, I'm just really curious, like, okay, try it out. But also just, you know, be aware of, like she said, what the studies look like and know that there's a reason you see a bunch of it all at once and then you don't hear about it again for a while. Like, it may have helped some people, but my thought process is always, if it was helping a lot of people, we would have been hearing about it consistently since 2016.
Oh, yeah, totally. Like, things that do help a lot of people, like sodium bicarbonate, there's a reason we hear about it still so much so many years later, and companies keep trying to innovate it so you don't, like, poop your pants from it during a race. It's because it actually works. Same with caffeine. These ones, like, it's kind of like beet juice, where it might have a small effect. Some people might have it more. It's really trendy for a bit. Then it's less trendy and it's not going to hurt you, but there's probably better things you could be spending your money on for performance gains.
Agreed. Like sleep.
Yeah.
Okay. So we had a question come in from Spotify. As a reminder, you can always leave comments and questions on individual podcast episodes. Most of these questions are coming into us from our Instagram at @treadlightlyrunning. So find us there, drop us your questions, leave us your notes so we can make sure we hit on your things in the future. But this one said, for a replacement spin workout, you said it needs to be longer. Is that in distance or time? Thanks for your podcast. You are welcome for our podcast. The general rule of thumb that I have seen is that it needs to be 1.5 to 2 times the time of the planned run you are going to do.
Yeah, I've seen that rule of thumb also. I don't always apply that rule of thumb when I'm giving athletes cross training, but for a lot of reasons, like there's a lot of reasons behind that. The distance will take less time on a bike, so you definitely end up doing way more distance than you would running. And then kind of like Amanda said, biking breaks you down less. You're probably not getting your heart rate as high up on the bike, especially if you're a runner who's not very efficient on the bike. So like we said earlier, we have to balance training time and training intensity. If you want a similar stimulus, you will have to go longer. Now, if you're replacing a spin with a run because you're injured, that is where I approach this a little differently. And I'll just give an equal amount of time, because when you're injured, we don't want to be breaking down your body. We want your body to have just enough to maintain fitness while also healing the muscle or bone that is injured.
Yeah, and that can be interesting too, because Dina Castor and I think it was Dimity from Run Like a Mother, both of them had to do race buildups where they spent a lot of time on the bike because they couldn't run. And so the bike itself wasn't causing pain where a run would. So in those cases, when you're doing the 1-to-1, it's probably kind of everything is leaning towards that 2 times the length of the run you were going to do. But like you said, if it's an injury situation, that's a totally different replacement. And we're really looking at what's going to get you back safely.
Our next question comes from at Laura Catherine Ross. How do I set up weekly runs when I'm not training for a race?
So I know we did an entire episode talking about the off season, and I'm never good with remembering what episode numbers they are. But I would definitely recommend listening to that entire episode, because I think there's such a variety of ways that you can look at this. So are you wanting to have a phase where you're sort of maintaining so that it's only going to be a month or 2 months and then you're going to get back into a training cycle? Or are you like, gosh, I need to kind of switch things up, and maybe right now I need to be doing heavy lifting and I'm only doing a couple of runs? So I think there's a lot of potential answers to this.
For the listeners, that's episode 10, very early on in the podcast this season. And I say, yeah, it very much varies. If you're not training for a race and it's months you have on hand, pick another goal to train for. So I'll have some athletes who decide that, you know, I don't have a race this spring, but I want to get faster in my mile time. Or I want to run 20 miles for the first time just because I can, not even for a marathon or something like that. I think it can help to have some reflection of what sounds exciting to you. What's a goal that you maybe have that isn't something you would be able to pursue when training for a race? Maybe it is getting strong and lifting more, and build your plan around that. If it's like truly an off season, be on structure, just get out and do what feels good within reason every day.
Yeah, I love that, because it's a chance for you to also get better at listening to your body. And so you get out there and start a run and you're like, this feels awful. Guess what? There's no race. So you can go home. Like, you can stop and just be like, okay, how do I feel the next day? Because I listened to my body yesterday. Gosh, this run is like just cranking. I'm feeling so much better because I listened. Or I don't feel like doing speed work today, so I'm just going to take it easy. I do think it's really, really important as runners to have phases where you're tuned into, gosh, I get to do this. Oh yeah, this is fun. And so figuring out what that might be. Maybe you now have time to catch up to a running group or a running friend because you don't have to hit a certain mileage, so you can jump in on some of those things.
Okay, we have another question then from Instagram at Pineapples_and_chaos said, any thoughts on Apple Watches for running? We do have thoughts. Yes.
I feel like we've probably mentioned this in at least a few episodes now. So standard Apple Watch is not accurate with GPS. And we know this. I would say it's probably on par to if you're using an app on your phone. It's roughly that accurate. So is that to say they're horrible? Nope, they will get the job done. If you don't need it to be super accurate, it's going to do the job. The Apple Ultra, now you're getting into $700, $800 watch, is suddenly super, super accurate because it's using all three satellite systems. It may even be more accurate in some instances than your Garmin because of things they've built in. But you can buy a Garmin that's accurate for $140. So that's always kind of my issue with, like, I don't really want to recommend that if you love Apple, the only way to use it is to buy the $800 watch.
Yeah, I agree a lot with that. Garmin, Coros, whatever you want to buy that is a running specific watch is cheaper. Yes, the Apple Ultra is accurate. I would say, like, if you're already using it, you can use it as a run watch, but don't go out and buy it because they are so expensive. I mean, they're really cool. My husband has one, but he also doesn't even use it for cycling. He uses his bike computer to track things while cycling. So he's not even using it for any sports. It's just he wanted a smartwatch. Yeah, so that's my take. And I know people will disagree, but it's just a hot take.
Yeah, I would say the other thing to kind of note is from all of my testing, your Apple Watch tends to be heart rate accurate while you're resting and heart rate really inaccurate while you're running. I've seen that pretty consistently and I've heard that from a lot of people too. So you're going to need to pair it with a heart rate monitor to get actually a decent reading from it.
Yes, yes. So then the final question we have for you today was from Jason. He wrote in, I wanted to ask, when it comes to strength training, what are your thoughts on the hip abductor and adductor machines? Should runners use them or avoid them? And I think this is like, can be a specific question, but it can also be a question on using strength training machines for runners.
Agree. I think machines kind of got a bad rap for a while, like, oh, you shouldn't be using them. But realistically, like, machines can be a great option. What they're kind of forcing you to do is work something in isolation. So if you're doing a standing movement, holding dumbbells or, you know, a barbell, you have to engage a whole lot more muscles in your whole body for good form and everything. Whereas in one of the machines, you can just really kind of isolate that you're working on your abductor or your adductor. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. It can be part of a good program.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Especially for people who might be new to resistance training, or maybe if you're not great with your form, machines can really help. So I would never say to avoid them. I think it comes down to, do you want to isolate this muscle or do you want to train it in conjunction with other muscles? Because, you know, when we're running and we're using the hip stabilizers like the ab and adductors, a lot of times we're using them with other muscles that control the hip and knee. So some people might find that for their needs specifically, things like Copenhagen planks, lateral lunges, etc., where you're using your adductors in conjunction with hip extension, knee flexion, core stabilization helps. Those are also really challenging exercises though. Like a Copenhagen plank is difficult. An adductor machine has a much lower point of entry, which is really beneficial for some people.
The Copenhagen plank, I feel like, has been the new social media darling lately. Yes. I have seen it on so many pages and it is nowhere near as easy as it usually looks in their videos.
No, sometimes with those videos, I'm like, is someone behind you supporting you? Like, they're just hanging out in a Copenhagen plank for like a minute. And really, when you get prescribed those in real life, it's like 15, 20 seconds because they're so difficult.
Very difficult. All right, runners, this was super fun. We absolutely love being able to answer your questions. So make sure you keep dropping them. And as always, if you found something helpful, share the episode with a friend. Save a runner some time.
Yes. And as always, please rate, review, and subscribe. We really appreciate it. It helps people find the show. It helps us know what you're thinking. And thank you for listening.